This creates a $1 billion instant deficit. This is sort of like press green button, create fiscal crisis.
The State House rejects a constitutional amendment on the permanent fund dividend. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a former Alaska Village public safety officer was arrested in Texas after fleeing child sex assault charges.
Maybe if the truth reaches more people, more girls or women will come forward with what has happened.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. The Alaska House on Thursday rejected a proposed amendment to the state constitution that would guarantee permanent fund dividends paid out according to a formula in state law. The amendment is a key part of a bipartisan plan to ease the state's fiscal woes, but it takes trust, and as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, some lawmakers say they're not confident their colleagues won't drive them off a fiscal cliff.
It was not an easy debate.
It's been a long time coming for this conversation. And you can feel the tension in the room.
That's Representative Sarah Vance, a Republican from Homer. House lawmakers have been waiting for more than a month to take a final vote on one key point of a long-term fiscal plan for the state, a constitutional amendment that would guarantee Alaskans a PFD based on a formula in state law. Representative Ben Carpenter, a Republican from Nikiski, brought the amendment forward.
The purpose of this constitutional amendment is to protect the permanent fund and improve the stability and predictability of our state finances.
For decades, the state paid out permanent fund dividends based on a formula in state law. That changed in 2016 when Governor Bill Walker vetoed half the payout. The Alaska Supreme Court upheld the veto, saying the PFD had to compete for money in the budget just like any other state program. And ever since, the PFD has been the subject of intense debate during the legislative session. In 2021, a bipartisan group of lawmakers put their heads together and came out with a report aimed at settling the annual debate. Among their recommendations was to create, quote, constitutional certainty for the PFD. And House Joint Resolution 7, if approved by the House, the Senate, and the voters, would do that. The problem, said Anchorage Democratic Representative Andy Josephson, is that the formula would pay out a much larger dividend than the state can afford. It would be more than $3,000 this year.
This creates a $1 billion instant deficit. This is sort of like press green button, create fiscal crisis.
Supporters of the amendment don't disagree with Josephson. Here's Mike Prox. He's a Republican from North Pole.
I think it's correct. It will, if passed, it will cause a crisis.
But Representative Craig Johnson, an Anchorage Republican who also backed the resolution, said it would make the formula rewrite a financial necessity.
And basically all this bill does is it forces us to make a decision.
But would it? Representative Jesse Sumner, a Republican from Wasilla, was a bit more skeptical.
I'm just not certain that there's the will in the body to actually address this, and I would like to know that.
He asked the House to show its commitment by advancing a bill that would change the formula. Instead of the older calculation, it would be set at 50% of the state's annual draw on the permanent fund. And the House agreed by a near unanimous vote, taking the bill out of the hands of the Finance Committee and sending it to the floor. But the move didn't explicitly link the two. The formula would have to pass on its own at an unspecified later date. Representative Justin Ruffridge, a Saldutna Republican, acknowledged that moving one item without the other would be an act of faith.
And I hope that this body has the intention and the trust with each other. I know that's difficult to have in the political arena, but we may have to have it. Just a little bit of trust that we can see this through to the end of the process.
And ultimately, the necessary two-thirds majority didn't have that trust. The resolution failed 22-18, 5 votes short of the two-thirds majority it needed to advance. Despite the setback, though, Carpenter says he's undeterred.
The only thing that we can do is to press forward and continue building support for something. And time will tell whether we're going to be successful at that.
And with only about a month left in the session, prospects in the short term are uncertain. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
A former Alaska Village public safety officer has been arrested after fleeing charges for sexually assaulting a minor in Florida. The former officer and pastor was arrested in Texas last week. As KUCB's Maggie Nelson reports, he stirred up some discomfort in the communities where he worked along the Aleutian Chain and Alaska Peninsula. And a content warning, this story includes discussion of sexual abuse.
Stephanie DeVault is a former Cold Bay resident. She was a church member when Monty Chitty started leading the ministry in the small Aleutian community.
Yeah, I used to Google him every couple of years just because we knew.
DeVault says she was upset, but wasn't surprised when she heard that Chitty had been charged with molesting a teenager at his congregation in Florida.
That we have serious doubts that this is the only girl that he has ever violated, and maybe if the truth reaches more people, more girls or women will come forward with what has happened.
Chitty spent nearly a decade in communities along the Alaska Peninsula and Aleutian Chain. He served as a church minister in Cold Bay and worked as a village public safety officer, or a VPSO, in False Pass in Accutan. He left the state just a few years ago. And on April 5th, 62-year-old Chitty was apprehended in a small town in Texas by state police and U.S. Marshals after attempting to flee child abuse-related charges in Florida. Chitty was arrested in March and charged with two felonies involving a young girl from the Baptist church he was leading. Those include sexual battery and molestation and a misdemeanor of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. According to a police report from the Monroe County Sheriff's Office, a 15-year-old female member of the church said she passed out on a couch in Chitty's office after he gave her alcohol. She later awoke to the pastor sexually assaulting her. Chitty went to the police before they spoke with the victim and attempted to get ahead of any allegations, denying he assaulted her. Detectives later found text messages that corroborated the allegations made by the young girl. Chitty admitted to sending the texts but denied sexual contact. Stephanie DeVault and her husband Tyron were both members of Cold Bay Chapel when Chitty arrived in 2010. They say a similar situation happened when a young woman came to church members in Cold Bay, showing them inappropriate messages from Chitty and saying she feared for her safety.
He got ahead of it and went to them and said, oh, those messages aren't what they seem like. She was making it up. She's a wayward girl. That's why she was staying with our family. And he was able to convince them that what he had written was not what it appeared to be. And we have the messages. There's no question what they are.
DeVault says a young woman was an extended family member of Chitty's and was living with him and his family at the time. She says she and some other parishioners helped the girl get to safety, get a plane ticket, and get out of town. Nothing ever came of the incident, DeVault says, because the girl was in her 20s. Still, she says it wasn't right.
While technically not illegal, it was obviously immoral and disgusting and all manner of other things.
DeVault says there were reservations about Chitty when he arrived and sought out a position at the church. But the congregation wanted a full-time minister, and he was willing to fill that role. DeVault says sometimes those positions are tough to fill in the remote community. The same can be said for VPSOs. They generally work with the Alaska State Troopers, and the program is managed under the state's Department of Public Safety. But the officers work with the Alaska Native organizations or regional municipalities that hire them. The public safety program has had trouble filling positions in the past. Michael Nemeth is the public safety coordinator for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. That's the regional tribal organization that hired Chitty. And Nemeth says it can sometimes be tough to find folks who fit the program and the remote communities they serve.
If you have someone who just wants to be a police officer, it's really not a good fit for the program. You know, you have to be committed to that whole ball of wax kind of thing where you're the jack of all trades, you know, and you wear many hats.
Chitty was hired as a VPSO by the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association in 2014 after leaving Cold Bay. He worked in False Pass for just 1 year. He was later stationed in Accutan for about 5 years. Nemeth says there were no serious complaints or allegations of sexual assault filed about Chitty while he served in the program. And he says he left on good terms with plans to buy a boat and try to retire in Florida. Like in many small or remote communities, resources for victims of sexual or domestic abuse can be difficult to find in the region. But Nemeth says the regional association is working to bolster their services. Chitty was arrested in Woodville, Texas, after he reportedly approached a church group that was working with people experiencing homelessness. A church member there contacted law enforcement, who apprehended him. He is being held on a $1.3 million bond. Reporting for KUCB, I'm Maggie Nelson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, mothers from Newtok share the difficulties of relocating their entire community due to climate change.
This is just one community of many that will need to be relocated in the state of Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us. An Alaska conservation group has released a new series of reports criticizing Alaska's state-owned investment bank as ineffective. The Alaska Beacon reports that economists Greg Erickson and Milt Barker wrote the reports on behalf of the group Salmon State. They concluded that the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority's flagship loan program created few new Alaska jobs and has accumulated a large endowment with little oversight. Salmon State is an initiative of the New Venture Fund, a left-of-center national organization, and opposes some of the infrastructure projects backed by ADA. The new reports arrive as ADA seeks permission from the Alaska legislature to borrow as much as $300 million for a variety of as-yet unidentified mining projects. The new reports follow a 2022 analysis that found state spending on ADA had cost Alaska $10 billion over 40 years and resulted in lower financial returns than a comparable investment in the Alaska Permanent Fund. That analysis did not account for job creation, something addressed in this week's reports. One of those reports found ADA had overstated by 94% the number of jobs its loan participation program, used by smaller businesses, had created. Salmon State is among several conservation groups opposing plans by ADA, the Matanuska Susitna Borough, and the Alaska Department of Transportation to construct a highway across the Susitna River in south-central Alaska. ADA rejected the new report's conclusions. Randy Ruaro, ADA's executive director, said by email that the agency disagrees with the new Salmon State-funded report's conclusions. It's been a snowy winter in Anchorage. So snowy, in fact, that 2023-2024 will go down as at least the city's third snowiest winter on record. A whopping 132.4 inches of snow, just a little over 11 feet, fell on Anchorage over the winter as of the latest measurement today. That's only 0.2 inches shy of the second snowiest winter of 1954 and 55, and about 2 inches less than the all-time record of 134.5 inches set in 2011 and 2012. But will the city see enough snow still this season to break either of those records? Not likely, at least for the all-time record, say National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider and meteorologist Carson Jones in this special edition of Ask a Climatologist. But Jones isn't ruling out a second-place finish just yet.
So if we get another shower or two that move over our measuring location in West Anchorage, say tonight, then we might get into that second place category. We only need 0.2 inches, but otherwise, as you get farther into April, we're just gaining a lot of daylight. The sun is getting stronger, particularly if it snows during the daytime hours. It's really hard to measure any accumulation, so it really has to happen overnight. But last year, we measured 1.7 inches in May, so there is that chance for something late season to happen that could throw us over into the record territory.
Yeah, I'm a little bit torn on this because I was out at your guys' office back in 2012 to see the measurement that broke the all-time record. So I'm kind of like, well, I got to see that. Like, I'm not really interested in us breaking the record as much. But how does that measurement actually work? It's been, you know, 12 years since I saw that happen. I've killed a few brain cells since then. So, like, what do you actually do? Is it a certain time of day? And how do you carry out that measurement?
Yeah, so with everything, it has to be standardized for the climate record accuracy. So we measure at a minimum 4 times a day, so 4 a.m., 10 a.m., 4 p.m., 10 p.m. But in conditions like this, like we had today, really heavy shower goes over, you might get some accumulation really quickly, but it's 35 degrees, so we go out and we'll measure that quickly just so it's not lost to melting, essentially.
Gotcha, yeah. And then are you... You just use like a ruler, or how do you do that?
Yeah, so we have a snow table in the yard behind our office, and that's a white surface, so it tries to not really absorb any heat. So we measure it on that table, and then we clear it off on those 6-hour increments.
Well, so Brian, I wanted to ask you, is there any significance climatologically? Does that tell you anything that we had such a huge snow year this year?
Not really, because if you look at, say, the last 15 years, you know, we had that record snow year in 2011-12, and this year that's near the record. We also had some pretty lousy snow winters as well. So over the last 15 years, our average snowfall is only 2 inches more than the long-term average. And so it can be a little bit difficult to communicate that when you have a big snow year and two in a row that maybe this is the new normal. But 2014-15, 2015-16, you know, 20 inches, 25 inches for the entire season. That could happen again. Let's hope not, but we should expect big snow years to be the normal now.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the difference that you would expect to see with climate change as the climate warms is that the atmosphere can hold more moisture, right? But with snowfall, that's more complicated than maybe more precipitation from more moisture, because you're also warming things up. And of course, it needs to be cold enough to snow, right? So how does that all work again?
So yes, but it is a little tricky, as you noted, with snow. So as you warm things up, the air can hold more moisture. And so as long as you're still below freezing, you can squeeze out more snowfall. So what we've seen in most of the mainland is an increase in snowfall for the core winter months, you know, December, January, February, and a dramatic reduction in snow in the fall and the spring. And so kind of the net is, you know, we're kind of hanging in there on snowfall, but we're really squeezing that snow season in. And all you have to do is look at, you know, Juneau. You know, if when you warm things up 3, 4, 5 degrees, you get a whole lot of winter rain. And so far in South Central, most of the mainland, we have avoided winter rain. We still get some, but not like they do down southeast. But that's probably our future in coming decades.
What's the snowpack like? I mean, the fact that there's still snow out there from like November seems to indicate that we would have a pretty deep snowpack right now. Is that the case?
Statewide, we're running at about 25% above normal for the snowpack. But here in Anchorage, we are at 22 inches for our snow depth. And that's kind of notable because we're only 2 days away from, 2 or 3 days from when we typically melt out our snowpack. So obviously it's going to be a little bit late this year. You know, if I had to guess, I would say probably about 10 days or so it'll melt out, because it tends to go pretty fast once it starts going. And we're supposed to get up to near upper 40s to maybe even near 50 degrees in 7 or 8 days. So it'll start melting in a big hurry.
That was National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider and National Weather Service meteorologist Carson Jones for what we're going to call Ask a Climatologist and his forecaster friend. A structure fire in Kivalina, a village of around 400 in the Northwest Arctic, burned down 2 buildings, damaged electrical equipment, and forced an evacuation on Tuesday. Emergency responders say the fire could have been much worse if not for the efforts of the community, who pulled together limited resources to contain the blaze. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports.
The fire broke out at a bingo hall on Tuesday afternoon, and Kivalina search and rescue representatives say residents got on VHF radio to rally for help. As the flames overtook the bingo hall, there was fear that the fire could spread to buildings nearby, including the village's power plant, community center, and church. Jeremy Zedek is the public information officer with the Alaska Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
First, we take our hats off to the village of Kivalina for preventing the spread of the fire further. They used heavy equipment to battle the fire that started in their bingo hall, and they tried to prevent it from spreading to their community building. They were dealing with very high winds.
The fire struck during a blizzard warning, with the National Weather Service reporting 45-mile-an-hour winds. A Kivalina search and rescue representative says responders used axes to chip away at the burning building and shoveled snow onto the flames. Later, they brought the city dozer and excavator to pile snow around the fire's perimeter and use the city's water truck. Responders say at some point, the fire truck ran out of gasoline and shut off the truck's pumps. Zedek says other responders pulled spectators away from the area as the fire edged near the village power plant.
They had a number of pieces of heavy equipment that protected the AVEC electrical plant there. When things did start to catch fire at that plant, they were able to extinguish them. They had a water truck that protected the church and the AVEC plant.
Search and rescue responders say a southwest wind blew the fire in the opposite direction of the community's power plant. A representative from the organization said on Facebook, the wind, quote, by far was the best first strategy in drawing fire away. The fire did, however, spread to and ultimately destroyed Kivalina's community center. Zedek says power was shut off at the plant and the community began to evacuate to Kivalina's new school as a precaution.
The school district opened up their school and sheltered about 250 people overnight. So that local response was tremendous.
Zedek says response from regional organizations was tremendous too.
The Northwest Arctic Borough, they sprung into action with assistance from the Red Dog Mine. They had a large amount of supplies and personnel that could be sent into Kivalina. They were able to get one plane in with the most essential personnel and supplies.
In response to the fire, Governor Mike Dunleavy issued an emergency declaration for the area on Wednesday. Zedek says the declaration allows the community to access public and individual funding assistance. Zedek says electricity was completely restored except for the community building since Thursday. Residents have since returned to their homes. The total damage from the fire still needs to be assessed, and the cause of fire is under investigation. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
For the second year in a row, a group of Alaska Native mothers from the village of Newtok reported on deteriorating conditions in their community at the annual Arctic Encounter Symposium in Anchorage. As KYUK's Emily Schwing reports, they say there will be no new homes built this summer as funding and logistics continue to complicate an effort to fully relocate the community.
The five women took to the stage barefoot in solidarity for their friends and family members who live in Newtok. It's a community in environmental peril.
The land is eroding to the sea, and there's going to ultimately be no more Newtok.
Christina Waska is the Newtok tribe's relocation coordinator. Deteriorating permafrost in the village means the ground is sinking under homes. The banks of the nearby Ninglick River have eroded away at a blistering pace over the last three decades.
I was raised in Newtok. And then several years ago, my parents' house, the home I grew up in, was demolished and the land eroded away with the sea. So I don't have a home in Newtok anymore.
For many years, the village has been working with several state and federal agencies to relocate the entire community, nearly 400 people, to hire more stable ground at Machtakvik. It's 9 miles across the Ninglick River. Carolyn George is a Newtok Village Council member.
And, you know, there is no blueprint on how to do this relocation. You know, relocating the whole community to a whole different place. And we did not know how to do it. And it's been taking too long.
George is also a mother to five daughters and Newtok's school secretary. Four of her daughters moved across to Machtakvik without her last fall.
I got my house in November, but I didn't move. I had my kids and their dad move over. I'm in Newtok because I work at the school. It's my 10th year. If I move, I'll be out of the job.
Available housing is the single greatest hurdle to fully relocating all of the remaining Newtok residents. But George told the audience there will be no new home construction in Machtakvik this summer, because the tribe was not able to order supplies and line up a barge in time for delivery this summer. The tribal council also dismissed its project manager and has since hired an Anchorage-based engineering firm to help design and build infrastructure in Machtakvik. Jackie Schaefer is the director of climate initiatives at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. She's been working with Newtok for years. She says no one considered the financial pressure the tribe would face managing two communities simultaneously.
Because they're in full relocation, it puts them in a really fragile position for infrastructure funding because they're trying to operate two communities with one funding source under one tribal governance. And so that causes all kinds of stress, not only on the infrastructure in both communities, but on the ability to maintain and operate on the side that, you know, half the residents still live in.
There are nearly 150 rural communities in Alaska considering partial and full relocations due to climate change-driven environmental disasters. Schaefer says lessons from Newtok and Mahtavik can inform those future projects.
And really, this just shows this is just one community of many that will need to be relocated in the state of Alaska. And if we can't figure it out for a community of under 400 people, there's no way when we hit Louisiana, LA, and all the other lower 48 communities that we're going to be able to figure it out.
In the meantime, Schaefer told the audience the mothers of Newtok are an inspiration. They're going to adapt, she said. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, and Emily Schwing in Anchorage. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.